From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the remarkable story of an effort to make CTs and MRIs less scary for children and yield better results. Plus, the contradictions of higher education during the Cold War.
Even as the Cold War is expanding universities and changing its direction in some ways, it's feeding this emergence of dissent.
We'll look at the state's program designed to help people save for college. And it's a Milwaukee woman's design adorning the new official NPR t-shirt.
I wear headphones a lot at work. So, yeah, I started there and kind of created a globe. Cityscapes, country, and suburbia. And I even have a little Capitol building in there. And NPR colors, of course.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. A collaboration being forged between Marquette University and the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design is aimed at developing design and engineering simultaneously. But the innovation on which Doug Dietz works is a reaction to what happens when function comes before form. Dietz works for Waukesha-based GE Healthcare, which makes imaging equipment like CT scanners. They do excellent diagnostic work. The trouble is they also frighten young patients, and that affects the kind of results the machines produce. Dietz set out to do something about that and joined us last month with a remarkable story of the result. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. What was the problem you set out to solve with this adventure series project?
Well, working at GE Healthcare, and we do a lot of kind of big diagnostic equipment. So it's big MRs and CTs. And actually, I call them shiny objects. So you have these big monster pieces of equipment. A lot of them, especially the MRI machines, can make a lot of noise and be very, very scary. And the experience of doing that, especially for children, can be traumatic. And then they have to sedate them, especially between 3 and 8 years old. They have to sedate the children probably 80% of the time so they hold still so that the scan looks good. So kind of the crux of the whole issue or the problem, or I guess you'd say reframe it to the opportunity, was why have we spent so much time just kind of almost like myopically thinking about the product itself and not taking it a couple of steps back and looking at the whole experience that, to be honest with you, the family is going through when they deal with the healthcare system. So that's really where it started, was seeing what can we do to just make the family's journey through their healthcare experience better.
This is what some engineers would call fairly clinically the user interface. But really what we're talking about is how people have real live experiences with the technology around them.
Yeah, so I think like our group in global design, that I'm a member of the global design team, we do the industrial design, so the product design of what it looks like and the user interface design. And that part is of course very important for any product, whether it's a car or a piece of medical equipment. But boy, that experience you go through, maybe even before you even get into the room, is a huge part of how it's going to go through. So we were actually thinking about this. We call it the anxiety journey of, from the very beginning that when you put your child in the car and you get to the hospital, all the way till when you see our equipment and your experience in the radiology department, till when you get home. So we tried to find solutions for these little anxiety points that the children go through when they go through this whole experience. Because it's crazy when you're trying to, especially if it's a child, in a lot of cases it has to go back to the hospital multiple times. And that's really tough. So they know when they're getting in the car, even if you tell them a little bit of a trick to get them going, but as soon as they see the hospital and they're following some blue line and going up, you know, 3 elevators to get to where they're going, they know what's going on, and then they'll see like a scanner that's making crazy noises or something, and the tears just start to come. And that's really where we wanted to focus with Adventure Series, of seeing how can we just totally change that whole environment. In fact, a lot of times we just describe it as, you know, what are 3 kitchen chairs and a blanket? And I mean, what are 3 kitchen chairs and a blanket?
They could be a fort.
They could be a castle. They could be a truck. They could be anything. And how long will your kids play with that? Forever. And that's where we said, oh, my gosh, because their imagination is so rich, and they just can come up with these ideas, and they can play with just these chairs and a blanket. I mean, I did too as a kid. And it's because you can take yourself to this special place. Well, why don't we, with Adventure Series, do that kind of thing and give them maybe a little bit more than three kitchen chairs and a blanket, and then allow them to take themselves and, to be honest with you, bring their family along with them to a special place so that when they go through the scan, actually it could be something that could be maybe even fun.
As fun as a CT or an MRI is likely to ever get.
Yeah, and I know, you know, for example, we really try to build the story around why would you lay on your back and hold still? Because for adults, if we go into a scan, we're like, okay, got it. You know, they're going to take a picture of the inside of me. But as a little one, you don't know. So like, for example, Cozy Camp, it looks, you know, the scanner looks like a huge tent, like a Eureka tent. And the table actually looks like a sleeping bag. So you lay on the sleeping bag and you go up and you go inside the tent. Well, the child totally understands that. In fact, sometimes they'll look over at the technologist and say, could you go in with me? And and, you know, the technology goes, no, no, you get to go in yourself, but if you need me. So actually we did on the wall, it actually looks like an old school kind of domed camper. And then through the window of the camper is where the technologist, because they need to leave the room and go in the other room to look into the, where the scanner is. So they just say, hey, no, I'm going to go in the camper. You get to go in the tent. And the kid goes, okay. And they got that. But that's a reason for them to lay still. So if you give them these elements of the story, they'll build on that. So whether it's, we have, you know, a pirate adventure, which is pretty cool. And it kind of has a part of the room that's got the shipwrecks that the little boys like, and then it goes into this beach kind of scene, which the girls like. So we kind of make it for everybody. So that's a pirate adventure is one. The nautical is one, which is the underwater where there's a submarine that the child lays on. It goes over a coral reef. That one's actually in the first one install that we did was actually in an ER, which was kind of crazy. So you think of this environment, this emergency room, which is just this hectic craziness. And in the middle of this is this really awesome nautical where it feels like you're underwater and you're taking the submarine ride over this coral reef. And it's just, you know, we call it tickling all the senses. So we have some aromatherapy that's in there. So in there we have a scent that's actually called clear water. So it has this kind of really nice kind of a water, I guess you'd say. And then it just takes a little bit of any of those little hospital smells out. And then we'll have, in that environment, for example, we'll have some music. I think they have like some harp or some music that your kids might be used to if they watch, you know, SpongeBob or something, you know, that kind of a thing. The lighting in that room is awesome. We have like an old school disco ball that's in the corner. And we just hit it with white light. And what's kind of neat about it is when it rotates around is when that little, it looks like a sphere, obviously, that it shines out. When it's close to the wall, it's kind of small. And then, of course, on the wall that's really far away, it's bigger. And they just look like bubbles. So it looks like you're underwater with bubbles.
And none of this interferes with the ability of the medical staff to be able to do its job?
No, it's pretty cool. And actually what they do, and actually in many cases, they've actually improved the amount of kids that they can get through. I think they're up like 7% as far as just the volume of patients. And to be honest with you, my hypothesis was that they were going to get less kids because they're going to want to play around. And we have cool characters. They're going to want to name them and hug them, which they do. But they actually are able to get them, they call it past the threshold, to get them up on the table and get ready for a scan quicker. So they're able to get more patients through. But you can imagine if that's your job every day to come into here and the technologists, they actually dress up in character, and then they just have this whole story going, and they're just, to be honest with you, they're just brilliant. I was in an MR the other day, and the MR looks like a spaceship, so that there's wings on the floor, and the whole system looks like the fuselage, and then our characters are on the windows inside, so little kids will come through, and they'll see the characters on the inside. They go, okay, it's safe to go in there. The character's in there. Well, it's just a sticker on the side, but for a kid, no, the toucan or the hippo or whatever inside the spaceship with their space uniform on, so it's okay to go in. But the technologists will get into the kind of the story, and you'll hear them say in the MRs, they have that kind of sound where it goes, dun, 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 grrr. So all of a sudden you hear them say, hey, Bobby, we are about ready to go to turbo speed. So just hold still. You're doing awesome. And, you know, you'll hear the engines going a little bit faster, and then it goes from dun, 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 grrr. And then the kid comes out, and, you know, this is like a gazillion-ton machine, right? And the little boy, little girl come out, and they'll see their parents, and they'll say, did you see how fast I was going? Well, the technologists, you know, they use those kind of setups to help, obviously, the family, but the child have a good time. and allows the technologists, I think, to also just, you know, if that's where you got to go in to work every day, that could actually be kind of fun. So we have, especially in the pirate adventure, they dress up in their pirate uniforms. And so, you know, those are some of the ones we have. We have Cozy Camp, which is a camping adventure. I think I talked a little bit about that. So there's a bunch of different ones.
Does it take a change in the way you think about things? I mean, your title is Innovation Architect, which is a term that I don't know that all of us are acquainted with. But does it take a certain mind shift on your part to be thinking, I'm working with medical devices, but I'm working to make them fun?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can tell you, you know, most of my career was as a product designer, industrial designer, was working actually on the piece of equipment itself. And to actually take a couple steps back, I almost think of about it like a drop in the pond, is that the machine itself is just that first pebble that drops. But you got to look at those other ripples all the way out. And the richer you look at some of those, the better the experience is going to be with actually that first pebble, which is the piece of machinery. So yeah, it actually took some of my first visits to the hospital, especially the pediatric hospitals, to see these families struggling with getting through and it just being brutal, and even having some of my children going through some of the experience with just the whole healthcare system. So there was a big shift, and I'll have to be honest with you. When I looked at some of the things that I did in product design, whether that's designing a new CT or MR scanner, and then seeing these families going through the experience and struggling with that, is I really felt like I failed at my job. So if my job is to design this MR, I stopped at just doing the piece of machinery itself. And I didn't look at the experience because, to be honest with you, it was failing. If you have to sedate 80% of the time the children to get a scan, that's terrible. You know, that's just not what it should be. So, yeah, it was kind of a little bit life-changing. So, you know, back then I was probably called senior designer or something. So innovation architect is really looking at innovative ways to look at this, you know, reframe this problem into an opportunity and how to do that. And Adventure Series just happened to be one that we worked with the Betty Brin, Fern Schupeck down at the Betty Brin Children's Museum here in Milwaukee. We worked with a lot of the child life specialists who work at the hospitals to help families get through, whether it's surgery or whatever. And I call them angels. I mean, they literally are angels. But worked with this kind of ensemble of characters to come together and help us develop this experience. I think our first brainstorming session was actually at a Bright Days Daycare Center right outside of our GE facility there, and working with the little kids and just seeing, having them collaborate with us to come up with some of these ideas. We worked a lot with the kids advisory boards, like in Chicago. We worked with them, so it was probably 15 kids that we worked with, and we did sketches and we mocked up little scale rooms and came up and just, you know, did prototyping and pilots, iteration together with our customers to come up with these ideas. So to be honest with you, when you look at some of the success of some of these, it's hard to say who did that. And we look at it and we just kind of look at each other and go, we did.
Do you think working on a project like this shapes how you will approach the next thing down the road?
I think it totally does. This has totally messed me up. So I just think that, you know, starting with empathy and figuring out where that is and letting the opportunities be derived from where that empathy source is totally changed how I think almost about anything. You know, where are you going to go on summer vacation? Start here. And working in a big company that our technology is just so cool, and where we come up with the technology and almost sometimes look backwards and saying, okay, now we got this neat thing, this neat technology. Where do we need to place it? And what can we do? And then ask the customers if they need it. This is flipping that whole thing around totally and going to our customer and saying, what are some of your issues? What are some of your problems? And talking with them and iterating with them to come up with some of these things. So, yeah, it's totally messed me up.
Doug Dietz, thank you so much for giving us some insight into it.
Now, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me to come in.
Doug Dietz's title is Innovation Architect at Waukesha-based GE Healthcare. He developed the Adventure Series, a child-friendly design for imaging machines. You can see pictures of several designs from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The designs are in use in pediatric hospitals and units around the country, but so far not in Milwaukee. Our interview first aired in September. How places like the University of Wisconsin-Madison found themselves torn by the Cold War. A new book examines that issue, and we'll learn about it when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Life Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. In the 1950s and 60s, as the Cold War heated up, if you will, universities like UW-Madison found themselves in an awkward situation. The schools were hotbeds for protest of federal policies linked to the Cold War, even as the federal government was increasingly funding programs at those schools to benefit Cold War policy. That interesting dichotomy is chronicled by Wisconsin writer Matthew Levin in his book Cold War University, Madison and the New Left in the 1960s. Levin spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Bloom and explained the phrase Cold War University.
Well, it's a term that I kind of borrowed, and what defines it is kind of this development in higher education after World War II, early years of the Cold War, where the federal government kind of steps in ways that it hadn't done before. And it really changed the way that higher education was funded, changed some of the purposes of higher education so that the University of Wisconsin, along with many other universities, large universities in particular, were involved in ways they had never been before in the nation's defense and particularly in the Cold War struggle. And you kind of see it a lot of different ways. You see it especially in funding for research programs, some of them military related but not all of them. And you also see it in scholarship programs, the National Defense Education Act, which comes along in the late 50s. So it's not, you know, something you can kind of put your finger on and say, aha, this was the moment when this started, or this is the crux of this. It's something that happened over time after World War II and kind of happened a little haphazardly. But by the time you get to 1960, you can really see that the university has shifted its footing somewhat from before.
But the Cold War University is also partly composed by a changing student population as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It is affected by a new generation of students. You, of course, get the returning veterans after World War II. And then later on, you get the baby boom generation. You definitely get students that are influenced in ways by the culture around them that, you know, didn't exist prior to the Cold War. So you get students that are growing up in a time of constant threat that had not existed in the past. Today, we've adjusted somewhat to the presence of nuclear weapons in the world. But in the late 40s and early 50s, that was a real presence in students' minds. And so a lot of students did come of age in the 1950s and 1960s not sure about the world that they were inheriting, not comfortable with it, alienated in some ways from their parents and from the policies of their government.
I want you to tell us a little bit about what you call the contradictions of Cold War era higher education.
Yeah, this is kind of a crucial idea in the research that I did and the writings that I've done on the topic. The idea is, you know, on the one hand, the University of Wisconsin and many other universities kind of get pulled into this Cold War development in the 1950s, especially in the 1960s. So you can definitely see that. You can see it in the expansion of universities. You can see it in the change in research that takes place, emphasis on sciences in particular. In Madison, the University of Wisconsin, you can see it in the creation, for example, of the Army Math Research Center, which is a big deal in the mid-50s and is kind of celebrated as a way of, you know, the university aiding the nation's defense and working with the Army in a cooperative way. And that was non-controversial when it opened in the mid-1950s. But in addition to that kind of direction, you get this paradoxical direction that comes as well. Along with the increasing student body, you get more and more students who are more likely to question what they're seeing around them, who are growing up during the Cold War, coming of age during this time, looking at the changes in the university, not always in positive ways. So even as the Cold War is expanding universities and changing its direction in some ways, it's feeding this emergence of dissent. So you kind of get these two situations that are running parallel to each other, but in very different ways, if that makes any sense.
You keep referencing Madison as one of many Cold War universities. So what is it about Madison that makes it in particular worth studying? Why not another Cold War university like Berkeley or Michigan?
That's a good question. And there's no doubt that there's plenty of reason to look into other Cold War universities. Berkeley and Michigan would be at the top of the list. Someone else wrote a book about Stanford and the creation of the Cold War University. There are plenty of other places to look as well. And part of the argument that I make in my research and writing is about the kind of national changes that are taking place. And Madison is just one place to see those changes, like kind of on a micro level. So you can kind of see them taking place. But there is something going on in Madison that's a little different. You see that come out in the kind of intellectual community that I write about, and that's this emergence of not only undergraduate students and graduate students, but also professors who are engaged in kind of an intellectual project to rethink American policies, especially foreign policy, to consider what a new direction on the left might look like. And then once this new direction on the left has taken hold, and they actually call it the new left, once that's taken hold, to start thinking about, well, where is this going? What are we trying to accomplish? How do we get there? And there is a real tension in the 1960s between activism, the popular images that we think of when we consider the 1960s, the protests, the rallies, the demonstrations, those kinds of things. There's a tension, and you really see it in Madison more than in some other places, I think, between the activism, which is common everywhere, and yet in Madison you also find this kind of intellectual direction. There are still people in Madison, even at the height of the protests, at the height of the rallies, at the height of the violence in the late 60s and early 70s, where folks are still talking about how do we make this movement into something lasting, into something permanent, into something that's going to really transform America.
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned Madison as a university that's as old as the state itself. So mm-hmm. There is also this special connection between the university and the state government, at least, even before the new left emerged.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So who were these people in the new left? What did the new left represent?
Well, there's a long strain in American politics, and people are familiar with the terms left and right, conservative and liberal, sometimes maybe radical or reactionary. These are all terms that are used to describe different political currents that exist throughout our history. The New Left was kind of a movement that emerged in the late 50s, early 1960s, that really tried to find a new direction for the left. Previous to this, the left in American politics had mostly been the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and there had been some electoral victories. In Milwaukee, for example, you have some prominent socialists who run for mayor and serve as mayor. You have socialists serving in the U.S. House of Representatives, representing the Milwaukee area. So there is this older left strain in American politics. But in the 1950s and 1960s, you get a group of young people in particular who are not too enamored with this older strain and who are trying to find a new direction, trying to rethink how to reshape America. And the real things that define the new left, for one, their kind of youthfulness defines them somewhat, their willingness to throw overboard what their parents and grandparents had done as socialists or communists, and also their emphasis on America's foreign policy and also issues of race that were brought on by the civil rights movement. So they are obviously interested in class issues like the left had been before them, but they kind of broaden the template somewhat and, of course, also incorporate activism in ways that the earlier left had not. And it was in reaction to the civil rights movement, in reaction to the Vietnam War, in reaction to the Cold War. So these new events pushed the left in new directions.
And also the creation of these Cold War universities and this federal funding into defense research spurred protest. The university's policy of allowing Dow Chemical to recruit on campus
right.
led to a series of protests in 1967, and it climaxed in a violent confrontation with the police. How did this event impact student protest movements in Madison?
Well, you can really see the impact of the Cold War when you start looking at the demonstrations. It's not just that every demonstration was against the Vietnam War. I mean, the Vietnam War was always there in the background once you get to 1965 or 1966. But the students don't just go out and demonstrate against the Vietnam War in an ambiguous sense. They really focus in on the university and its sponsorship, its participation in the Vietnam War and in the Cold War, and its close partnership with the federal government. And so the Dow demonstration is really focused on the university's willingness to allow large corporations that are engaged in Dow's case, making napalm for the war effort, the university's willingness to let these corporations and at other times groups like the CIA come onto campus and recruit students who are willing to work for them in the future. So you really get students reacting to the university's partnership in a way with large corporations and with the federal government. And that creates the real impetus for a lot of the demonstrations. Another example is in 1966, there was a large draft sit-in. And it was an anti-draft sit-in, but it was focused again on the university and its partnership with the Selective Service System in offering draft exams, in offering up student GPA information, all this kind of stuff. And the student protesters didn't want the university to participate in this. You know, they were opposed to the draft. They were opposed to the Vietnam War, but they kind of zeroed in on the examples of the university's relationship with the federal government and the Cold War. Later on, of course, in the most – perhaps the most famous event was the 1970 bombing of Sterling Hall, which housed the Army Math Research Center, which in the 1950s had been totally non-controversial. I couldn't find one peep of anybody thinking it was a bad idea. And by the late 60s, you know, the students are up in arms over the university's willingness to house an Army Math Research Center on its campus.
Do you feel that these protest movements were effective in causing change with the university and its relationship to the federal government?
That's a tough question, a good one. And I try and tackle it a little bit in the book, but there's no easy answer. The short answer as far as changing the university is no. The university didn't really shift all that much. In some ways, university administrators, the regents, the state government just simply outlasted the protest movement. And there were some changes. There was a teaching assistance union created. There was a Black Studies department created. Students got new roles in kind of governance of the university. So they were included on committees and things like that. So there certainly were some changes. But in a larger aspect, the university did not fundamentally change from the direction it had taken after World War II and beginning with the Cold War. In a larger sense, though, if you start to look past the university, you can start to see some of the real changes.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Matthew Levin's book is called Cold War University, Madison and the New Left in the 1960s, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Levin, who also teaches high school social studies in McFarland, Wisconsin, spoke with Rachel Bloom over the summer. Wisconsin works to encourage more people to save for college. We'll learn how when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effects. I'm Mitch Teich. One area that concerns many economists in this country is the rate of savings. Americans held on to more money during the Great Recession, but savings rates have been going downward ever since. In Wisconsin, the state is trying to encourage more people to put away money for college. The threshold for investing in the state's 529 plan, in fact, has been lowered in recent months. Jim DiIulio is the Wisconsin 529 College Savings Director for the state, and he's with us in the studio now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Good deal. I'm happy to be here today.
What is the significance of a 529 plan versus any other way of saving for college?
You know, saving for college is something that all families think about. 529s have only been around about 15, 16 years now. And what they can do is they offer a lot of advantages. There's professionally managed investments, a number of tax advantages, both federal and state. And then, of course, being they're so large, people can take advantage of institutional pricing, which means that you as an individual can invest at fees much, much lower than you could just as a single person.
There are state-specific plans. Each state is allowed to set up its own version of the 529 plan. There are two in Wisconsin. If I understand correctly, though, people from outside Wisconsin can choose to invest in Wisconsin's plans, and likewise a Wisconsin resident could choose to invest through another state's 529 plans. So what is it that distinguishes what's available in Wisconsin?
Well, yeah, you're correct there. There's about 80 plans altogether across America, and you're actually free to invest in any of them. But there is kind of a state advantage because these are actually state-issued securities. And states that have income taxes, such as Wisconsin, also have benefits for their state residents. For example, here in Wisconsin, you can claim a tax deduction of up to the first $3,000 for each student each year into the account that you wouldn't be able to get from, say, the Iowa plan, which also has a tax deduction for their residents.
How has Wisconsin's 529s, this is Ed Vest and Tomorrow Scholar, how have they evolved over time?
You know, that we've only been around, like I said, 15 or 16 years now. But between both plans, we have over $3 billion, with a B, and more than 200,000 families saving, most in Wisconsin, but actually some all across the country. People find that we've had good selections and low fees.
Well, and along those lines, have things changed in terms of the threshold it takes for someone to start one of these plans?
Well, you know, at first, you know, we were all kind of trying to feel our way here, but sometimes the obstacle is it just takes a little time to get started. And just recently, last October, we decided to drop the price of admission, if you will, to $25 just to get an account open. No obligation. You can add to it. Now, obviously, $25 is not going to get you to college. But if nothing else, at least to get you started on the path. You know, savings is a kind of a regular habit. You can set things up where you can have money automatically drawn out of your checkbook or your credit union account every month or twice a month if you'd like. There are a number of employers that have also set up payroll deduction, which is also very handy to do.
Well, and so do the math for us. What does it take to make a significant difference? How quickly do things add up? And why do this versus just, you know, put the money under a mattress?
Well, the one that gets everybody excited is the tax benefits, because as long as the dollars are used at the other end for higher education expenses, and that can include anything, tuition, room, board, books, lab fees, all that sort of thing, there are no federal or state taxes due on the growth. So, I mean, that's a significant savings both with federal and state income taxes. And then at the same time, you can also get a deduction here as a Wisconsin resident by putting money in. So everything else considered, it's a very, very efficient way to save money.
What, if any, are the risks in this kind of investment?
Well, you know, and risk is his thing, because obviously you can invest in the stock market. And are things risky? Yes, you can lose all your money. But that's just like in a 401k or whatever. The trick is to moderate your risk and to kind of know what your tolerances and things are. A lot of times as you get closer to college, you want to start putting your investments in more bonds and more stable investments there to kind of lock in what growth you've had. But a lot of times when your kids are young, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, you can afford to take some risk in the stock market, same as you would in a retirement plan if you're 25 or 30 years old. So it's like a retirement plan, only compressed into maybe 10 or 15 years or so.
Well, and so how much manipulation, if you will, do you have to do when you open up an account? I mean, is it as simple as just starting with $25 or $50 or $100? Or once you get to that point, you know, what are your options?
Well, you have a lot of choices. In our Edvest plan, we have over 20 different selections. You can be in very simple guaranteed interest investments or CDs of the bank. You can also get into a variety of mutual funds type of investments. One of the most popular ones is what they call the age-based tracks, and these are actually automatically changed every couple of years. And so we have professional investment people that design the portfolios, a mix of stocks and bonds and cash. And every couple of years, they get a little more conservative as the kids get closer to college.
And the diversification has the potential to both pay better results but also reduce some of the risk along the way?
Risk is the big thing. You know, is a lot of times with investing, I've been in the investment business for a long time, and people just look at growth. But actually, the most important thing is to moderate the risk. And by being diversified into a lot of different asset classes, stocks, bonds, that sort of thing, you can actually make your savings and work for you rather than worry and have to lie awake every night of whether you made the right choice or not.
There's been some criticism in the investment community since the 529s came along about, as you say, 15 or 16 years ago, about what's known as the expense ratio versus in some other mutual funds. What are we talking about when we hear that term? And where does a program like Edvest fall in that ratio?
Well, that's the thing I was talking about, the institutional pricing, because all investments have some sort of overhead fees because somebody has to design the portfolio and buy and sell the stocks. Even index funds have to have those things. And what we're allowed to do with a program like Edvest or any 529 plan is we work on a really large numbers. And so if you think about it, we have hundreds of millions of dollars to invest. And so we get the same type of pricing that, let's say, a foundation or some sort of endowment would get. So actually the cost of investment is probably in most cases less than 0.5%, 0.25% for everything, which also includes some of the overhead, you know, to pay for mailing the statements and doing that sort of thing. And there's some legal things we have to file.
Talk about the actual process for opening an account. How can someone actually get going on this?
Well, an account has two parts. There's an owner, and then there's what they call the beneficiary. And the owner is usually an adult, and oftentimes the parent or a grandparent. It doesn't necessarily have to be that, but just an adult. And then the beneficiary is a potential student, and you have to have Social Security numbers, and you can set it all up. Now, the question always comes up, well, what happens if my kid's not going to go to college? Well, 529 rules are very family-friendly. Let's say that one of your kids decides not to go to college for a while. You can certainly take that balance and transfer to another beneficiary, and that pool is large too. In addition to other kids in your family, they can include cousins, nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, just about anybody that comes for Thanksgiving dinner.
But you cannot at this point invest on behalf of a hypothetical kid down the road.
No, you can't, because obviously there has to be a Social Security number and something. But what sometimes the people do is you can also use a 529 account for yourself, because let's say you want to take some additional classes or further education. And there have been cases here and then where maybe someone wants to take advantage of a tax deduction before the end of the year, but the baby's not yet born. So you can actually open an account in your name with as the owner and beneficiary. And then when your son or daughter is part of your family, you can just change the beneficiary at that time.
You mentioned the idea of Thanksgiving dinner, friends, relatives. Is this a plan that friends and relatives or grandparents can contribute to?
This happened with more frequency. I think that, you know, a lot of folks that are our parents, the grandparents, that sort of thing, are more than happy to help with the kids and get them off to school. And so there's a lot of gifting and things involved. We've got a brand new thing right now, which we call e-gifting. You can actually set everything up right on your computer. The money is actually taken securely from your bank account or whatever. And there's some forms that you can print out. You can even print out a little gift card for the person, whether it's a happy birthday thing or whatever kind of accomplishment. And then also here in Wisconsin, both grandparents and aunts and uncles also can claim a tax deduction for that same child. It multiplies. There's a lot of things that are available, but the e-gifting is new. And the nice thing about it, it's free. There are services out there that'll aggregate your dollars and forward them, you know, for some sort of a fee. But Wisconsin, like most states, said, wait a second, this doesn't make sense. I mean, 100% of the gift should go to the kids.
You are an employee of the state of Wisconsin, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So explain, what is the state of Wisconsin's relationship to the two programs? I know you oversee them, but as the state of Wisconsin, what is the state's responsibility to the people that invest in these programs and the programs themselves?
Okay, this is a little bit of inside baseball here, but but technically 529 plans are what they call municipal securities, and these are the siblings of municipal bonds. That allows us to give the state tax break. And the entire program, though, however, is self-supporting through the small amount of fees we charge to people. So there are no tax dollars used in this program at all. All the dollars are there for the benefit of the owners and the beneficiaries of the plan. But then the state, of course, supervises things. We're just finishing up our audits right now, and we have outside auditors and other experts to obviously keep everything legal and properly posted, and we'll have the audits posted on our websites coming up here in about a month or two.
And do I understand, is there's some relationship to Tia Cref, is that right?
Yeah. Every state usually partners with some sort of a commercial entity, and TIAA Cref has been around for a long time. They're really active in the retirement business, and Wisconsin is one of the 11 states where they manage the program for us. And we have a wonderful relationship with these folks. They do a lot of the record-keeping things for us. And then again, by working in a number of other states, there's some economies of scale when we go out and we need to buy advertising services or internet services.
And if I'm not mistaken, this all can get going for an individual or family online, right?
You can do it online. You know, in the time it takes to drink a cup of coffee and you have some Social Security numbers, you can set things up. You can also set up multiple accounts. Our website now is sophisticated enough to actually, let's say you want to do two or three grandchildren, you can do it all at once, and it doesn't take long at all. Now, for those that prefer the old pencil and paper way, we certainly have that too, and we can send you the enrollment kit, and you can have that in your hands probably in a few days.
Very good then. Jim DiIulio, thanks so much for giving us the lowdown on 529s, if
well,
you will.
Good, and we're happy to be here. And you can follow us on Facebook at EdVest, and we also are on Twitter. And both of those sites also include some really good tips here for parents planning for college and that sort of thing too.
Great. Thank you so much.
Very good.
Jim DiIulio is the 529 College Savings Director for the state of Wisconsin. You'll find a link to more about the state's EdVest program at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Our interview first aired last month. One last break, and then we'll meet the Milwaukee woman whose work will soon be sported by public radio fans everywhere. Warning, shameless self-promotion ahead. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Public radio listeners can often wear their affection for this medium on their sleeve. And now that might literally be the case. A Milwaukee woman's design has been chosen as the new official NPR t-shirt, the result of a contest by the website Threadless.com. Jessica Rausch is a textile designer for Kohl's Corporation by day and public radio listener by, well, by day as well. We invited her to stop by to share the story of the shirt and the story of herself. Nice to meet you.
Thanks.
What made you want to enter this contest in the first place? This is something done through through Threadless.com.
It is. First of all, I love Threadless. And for me, it was a good medium for just exploring what I like outside of work, too.
Was there something about NPR that that made this resonate especially strongly?
Yeah, I thought it was a good challenge because not only is it about sound, duh, which is not easily expressed visually, but I love NPR.
Describe the design you came up with. How did it come together?
I wear headphones a lot at work. So, yeah, I started there and kind of created a globe. Cityscapes, country, and suburbia. And I even have a little Capitol building in there and NPR colors, of course. So I wanted something that's really wide and broad-reaching.
Do you remember how long it took to go from, okay, I want to enter this contest to the finished drawing?
I saw the NPR contest right around the first time that I was playing around with the Threadless entries. Just, I think it was only a week. And then I kind of started sketching around, and that was probably the hardest part for me, and running ideas off of different people.
How did you find out that you won?
Through an email. I was at work, and needless to say, I was a little bit excited, so a few expletives may have escaped my mouth, and everybody was really excited for me at work, and I remember I went out to eat a celebratory sushi dinner with my boyfriend, and I was like, oh my God, is this a hoax? This is probably a hoax email. This is not real, and I really didn't believe it until I got the prize package in the mail a week later with the NPR book that was signed by the different personalities at NPR and then also the iSong book. So then I was like, okay, this is probably real.
Well, and so this is not that different a project than what you do in real life, right? I mean, you are something called a textile designer, which means what?
Yeah, I'm a textile artist. I work on home products at Kohl's Corporate. So we, for that department, we work on anything from soft home, which is bedding and bath products and table linens, to more of the hard product, which is decor and trim, dinnerware, anything like that. So not only is there a huge scope of categories like that, but there's also a big scope of art styles too. So,
well, and Kohl's is not some little known boutique. This is a store that's all over the place. When you are out and about, do you ever encounter products that you've had a hand in designing?
Yeah, it's kind of exciting, actually. And sometimes it's a surprise even. You're like, I didn't know that actually went in, but it did.
You're at somebody's house and you go into the bathroom and they're hanging from the towel bar or are towels that you might have designed the pattern for.
Yeah, that hasn't happened to me quite as much as some of my coworkers that have been around longer. Since we do work over a year ahead, you're on a completely different wavelength when you come into the store and you see something you did a year later or a year before. So it's pretty cool. And you kind of see the process from where it started, where you began, to the final product. It's pretty cool.
But presumably, in contrast to the way a contest like the Threadless contest works, you have some pretty strict guidelines that you're working under, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a very specific prompt, and it's a very long, drawn out. They know exactly what will sell between like the distance between the eyes. There's a science to the distance between a snowman's eyes, and the color red sells well versus color yellow sells well. There's a science to it, and I think that's a really exciting part of retail, is just the intricacies of each category.
So what was it that drew you to this particular subgenre of the art world, if you will?
Well, I work a little bit less in textiles versus what I went to school for, which was a double degree in textile technology and art and design at NC State, North Carolina. Right now, it's mostly graphic design and illustration kind of things with painting, which I feel extremely fortunate to have that as my job title. But the retail part of it was really interesting because as a corporate artist, you kind of have to tackle different illustration styles and art styles.
Well, so then is it safe to say that you've got you have an ability to scratch different artistic itches based on, you know, whether it's the stuff that you do in your day job versus the self-directed stuff like this t-shirt contest?
Yeah, I think that's the case with myself and quite a few of my coworkers too, where we have full control over what we do outside of work, which is kind of liberating when things get chopped, things get changed at work, and sometimes you get really attached to something and you just can't help it. If you work on it for, you know, a month, you're going to get attached to something. And that's why I got into doing work outside of work, I guess you could say.
Well, and what's the other kind of work? I mean, you said you'd entered a few other threadless contests before, but what's the other kind of self-directed projects that you're doing?
I do a lot of painting, watercolor painting most of all, and I've been getting into some more typography. I also have some items on Etsy, just a casual plug there. So you can check those out. My style's not really specific necessarily, so what I'm inspired by and what interests me seems to change daily. So,
do you carry a sketchbook around?
Yes. Yeah, I do.
So the big question, do you have one of these shirts yet?
I don't, actually. Surprisingly, I spent some of my gift card a few days ago, so I just got the box in today.
Are they going to give you one of these shirts?
They came in two shipments because I ordered so much.
So there is at least one on the way.
Yes, they're probably coming tomorrow. I think I ordered like five for my family and friends.
Everybody knows what they're getting for Christmas this year.
Yes.
Well, Jessica Rausch, thanks so much for spending some time with us and sharing your story. Congratulations.
Thanks again. Thank you for having me.
Jessica Rausch of Milwaukee won the NPR T-shirt design contest through Threadless.com. In her other life, she's a textile designer for Kohl's Corporation in Menominee Falls. You can see the winning design and also find out how to buy the WUWM-specific edition of the shirt at WUWM.com. We are just a few days out from All Hallows Eve. Halloween is Thursday and frightening opportunities abound. Count Lake Effect essayist Liam Callanan as not all that excited.
There is nothing scarier to me than a haunted house. Not a real haunted house, a commercial haunted house. A haunted house you pay to enter, a haunted house that this time of year seems to magically appear everywhere. These operations frighten me because the people who build them frighten me. It's part of the larger problem I have with Halloween. I don't see the fun in being scared. So I definitely don't see the fun in being someone who likes to scare other people, much less charge them for it. It's not a cliche, then, to say my worst fears were realized when earlier this month my children's school asked me to help them build a haunted house for their Halloween festival. To clarify, because there's nothing scarier than me swinging a hammer, I was asked to concentrate instead on writing a script for the haunted house, a backstory, something those staffing the house could draw from as they went about scaring people silly. Imagine a person who hates sudden drops being put in charge of designing a roller coaster, someone who hates beer being assigned Oktoberfest, the Grinch suiting up as Santa. And then imagine me. My first script called for all the lights to be on, no makeup to be worn, and definitely no fake blood. It would be a kind of anti-haunted house, a behind-the-scenes look that my daughters vetoed this immediately. My next script was for a Phantom of the Opera-style haunted house, which would make use of the fact that the school was constructing the haunted house behind the curtain of its actual stage. The storyline would be a school constructing a haunted house backstage. The school vetoed this. And then I experienced that moment familiar to anyone who has seen a haunted house movie or actually been in a haunted house. I just gave up and surrendered to the dark. The script I then wrote had children make a choice at the outset: climb the stairs up into the school, or choose to go through a door marked, of course, danger, and descend into a dark underworld. Here lied a maze, coffins, a strange figure in a rocking chair, a cobwebbed living room, a stomach-churning dining room, and a winding passageway out that takes far too long to navigate. It was so scary I didn't even like walking it with the lights on. And yet when everyone else walked it, of course, the lights were almost all out, and it was very, very dark. Which is just as it was the one and only time I've ever been in an actual haunted house. Or did I not tell you this? Well, it was some years ago, and like a true haunted house, I did not pay to enter. The structure itself was very old and remote, 5 miles out of a town that was itself 5 hours from the closest real city. It was filled with antiques and seemed charming for as long as the sunlight held, but sunlight always flees faster on such occasions, and soon enough it was dark, and more to the point, time to sleep. I was visiting a family. They lived in another brand-new house nearby, but their bedrooms were all full up. I would be sleeping here. After putting out the last light, I fell asleep, the dust around me so thick it choked everything into silence. Perfect silence, until just past midnight when I awoke to the screen door slamming. The wind, yes, we always blame the wind, but this was an absolutely windless night. I know, because I listened then, very hard, because I wanted to know very much if the door was slamming because someone had just left or because something had just come in. I'd never been someone who slept well. I sleep less well now. Years later, I still wake up sometimes at night and listen and think about what happened that night there in the dark, about the fact that I've never told anyone what happened next, about the fact that I'm really, really not the person you want to design your haunted house.
Liam Callanan is a professor of English at UW-Milwaukee and author of the novels All Saints and The Cloud Atlas. That's Monday's Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, Gale Foods president and CEO Catherine Gale on her corner of the dairy industry and her take on the debt ceiling crisis. Plus, Milwaukee's complicated public transit history, and former Packer George Kuntz talks about his PhD work, the trouble former players have in adjusting to life after the NFL. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.